the good years. The reason Carlos had good years was not just because he bought emerging market bonds and their value went up over the period. It was mostly because he also bought dips. He accumulated when prices experienced a momentary panic. The year 1997 would have been bad had he not added to his position after the dip in October that accompanied the false stock market crash that took place then. Overcoming these small reversals of fortune made him feel invincible. He could do no wrong. He believed that the economic intuition he was endowed with allowed him to make good trading decisions. After a market dip, he would verify the fundamentals and, if they remained sound, he would buy more of the security and lighten up as the market recovered. Looking back at the emerging market bonds, between the time Carlos started his involvement with these markets and his latest bonus check in December 1997, one sees an upward-sloping line, with occasional blips, such as the Mexican devaluation of 1995, followed by an extended rally. One can also see some occasional dips that turned out to be excellent buying opportunities. It was the summer of 1998 that undid Carlos. That last dip did not translate into a rally. His track record up to that point included just one bad quarter. But bad it was. He had earned for his bank close to $80 million, cumulatively, in his previous years. He lost $300 million in just one summer. What happened? When the market started dipping in June, his friendly sources informed him that the sell-off was merely the results of a liquidation by a New Jersey hedge fund run by a former Wharton professor. That fund specialized in mortgage securities and had just received instructions to wind down the overall inventory. The inventory included some Russian bonds, mostly because yield hogs, as these funds are known, engage in the activity of building a diversified portfolio of high-yielding securities. Averaging down. When the market started falling, he accumulated more Russian bonds at an average of around $52. That was Carlos' trait, average down. The problems, he deemed, were nothing to do with Russia, and it was not some New Jersey fund run by some mad scientist that was going to decide the fate of Russia. "Read my lips. It's a liquidation," he yelled at those who questioned his buying. By the end of June, his trading revenues for 1998 had dropped from up $60 million to up $20 million. That made him angry. But he calculated that should the market rise back to the pre-New Jersey sell-off, then he would be up $100 million. That was unavoidable, he asserted. These bonds, he said, would never, ever trade below $48. He was risking so little to possibly make so much. Then came July. The market dropped a bit more. The benchmark Russian bond was now at $43. His positions were underwater, but he increased his stakes. By now, he was down $30 million for the year. His bosses were starting to become nervous, but he kept telling them that, after all, Russia would not go under. He repeated the cliché that it was too big to fail. He estimated that bailing them out would cost so little and would benefit the world economy so much that it did not make sense to liquidate his inventory now. "This is the time to buy, not sell," he said repeatedly. "These bonds are trading very close to their possible default value. In other words, should Russia go into default and run out of dollars to pay the interest on its debt, these bonds would hardly budge." Where did he get this idea? From discussions with other traders and emerging market economists, or trader-economist hybrids. Carlos put about half his net worth, then $5 million, in the Russia principal bond. "I will retire on these profits," he told the stockbroker who executed the trade. Lines in the sand. The market kept going through the lines in the sand. By early August, they were trading in the 30s. By the middle of August, they were in the 20s, and he was taking no action. He felt that the price on the screen was quite irrelevant in his business of buying value. Signs of battle fatigue were starting to show in his behavior. Carlos was getting jumpy and losing some of his composure. He yelled at someone in a meeting, "Stop losses are for schmucks. I'm not going to buy high and sell low." During his string of successes, he had learned to put down and berate traders of the non-emerging market variety. Had we gotten out in October 1997 after our heavy loss, we would not have had those excellent 1997 results, he was also known to repeat. He also told management, "These bonds trade at very depressed levels. Those who can invest now in these markets would realize wonderful returns." Every morning, Carlos spent an hour discussing the situation with market economists around the globe. They all seemed to present a similar story. This sell-off is overdone. Carlos' desk experienced losses in other emerging markets as well. He also lost money in the domestic Russian ruble market. His losses were mounting, but he kept telling his management rumors about very large losses among other banks, larger than his. He felt justified to show that he fared well relative to the industry. This is a symptom of systemic troubles. It shows that there was an entire community of traders who were conducting the exact same activity. Such statements, that other traders had also gotten into trouble, are self-incriminating. A trader's mental construction should direct him to do precisely what other people do not do. Toward the end of August, the bellwether Russia principal bonds were trading at below $10. Carlos' net worth was reduced by almost half. He was dismissed. So was his boss, the head of trading. The president of the bank was demoted to a newly created position. Board members could not understand why the bank had so much exposure to a government that was not paying its own employees, which disturbingly included armed soldiers. This was one of the small points that emerging market economists around the globe, from talking to each other so much, forgot to take into account. Veteran trader Marty O'Connell calls this the firehouse effect. He had observed that firemen with much downtime, who talk to each other for too long, come to agree on many things that an outside impartial observer would find ludicrous. They develop political ideas that are very similar. Psychologists give it a fancier name, but my friend Marty has no training in behavioral sciences. The nerdy types at the International Monetary Fund had been taken for a ride by the Russian government, which cheated on its account. Let us remember that economists are evaluated on how intelligent they sound, not on a scientific measure of their knowledge of reality. However, the price of the bonds was not fooled. It knew more than the economists, more than the Carloses of the emerging market departments. Louis, a veteran trader on the neighboring desk who suffered much humiliation by these rich emerging market traders, was there, vindicated. Louis was then a 52-year-old Brooklyn-born and raised trader, who over three decades survived every single conceivable market cycle. He calmly looked at Carlos being escorted by a security guard to the door, like a captured soldier taken to the arena. He muttered in his Brooklyn accent, "Economics, schmeconomics, it's all market dynamics." Carlos is now out of the market. The possibility that history may prove him right at some point in the future has nothing to do with the fact that he is a bad trader. He has all of the traits of a thoughtful gentleman and would be an ideal son-in-law. But he has most of the attributes of a bad trader. And at any point in time, the richest traders are often the worst traders. This I will call the cross-sectional problem. At any given time in the market, the most successful traders are likely to be those that are best fit to the latest cycle. This does not happen too often with dentists or pianists, because these professions are more immune to randomness. John, the high-yield trader. We met John, Nero's neighbor, in Chapter 1. At the age of 35, he had been on Wall Street as a corporate high-yield bonds trader for 7 years, since his graduation from Pace University's Lubin School of Business. He rose to head up a team of 10 traders in record time, thanks to a jump between two similar Wall Street firms that afforded him a generous profit-sharing contract. The contract allowed him to be paid 20% of his profits, as they stood at the end of each calendar year. In addition, he was allowed to invest his own personal money in his trades, a great privilege. John is not someone who can be termed as principally intelligent, but he was believed to be endowed with a good measure of business sense. He was said to be pragmatic and professional. He gave the impression that he was born a business person, never saying anything remotely unusual or out of place. He remained calm in most circumstances, rarely betraying any form of emotion. Even his occasional cursing, "This is Wall Street," was so much in context that it sounded, well, professional. John dressed impeccably. This was in part due to his monthly trips to London, where his unit had a satellite supervising European high-yield activities. He wore a Savile Row tailored dark business suit with a Ferragamo tie, enough to convey the impression that he was the epitome of the successful Wall Street professional. Each time Nero ran into him, he came away feeling poorly dressed. John's desk engaged principally in an activity called high-yield trading, which consisted in acquiring cheap bonds that yielded, say, 10%, while the borrowing rate for his institution was 5.5%. It netted a 4.5% revenue, also called interest rate differential, which seemed small except that he could leverage himself and multiply such profit by the leverage factor. He did this in various countries, borrowing at the local rate and investing in risky assets. It was easy for him to amass over $3 billion in face value of such trade across a variety of continents. He hedged the interest rate exposure by selling U.S., U.K., French, and other government bond futures, thus limiting his bet to the differential between the two instruments. He felt protected by this hedging strategy, cocooned, or so he thought, against those nasty fluctuations in the world's global interest rates. The quant who knew computers and equations. John was assisted by Henry, a foreign quant whose English was incomprehensible, but who was believed to be at least equally competent in risk management methods. John knew no math. He relied on Henry. "His brain's in my business sense," he was wont to say. Henry supplied him with risk assessments concerning the overall portfolio. Whenever John felt worried, he would ask Henry for another freshly updated report. Henry was a graduate student in operations research when John hired him. His specialty was a field called computational finance, which, as its name indicates, seems to focus solely on running computer programs overnight. Henry's income went from $50,000 to $600,000 in 3 years. Most of the profit John generated for the institution was not attributable to the interest rate differential between the instruments described previously. It came from the changes in the value of the securities John held, mostly because many other traders were acquiring them to imitate John's trading strategy, thus causing the price of these assets to rise. The interest rate differential was getting closer to what John believed was fair value. John believed that the methods he used to calculate fair value were sound. He was backed by an entire department that helped him analyze and determine which bonds were attractive and offered capital appreciation potential. It was normal for him to be earning these large profits over time. John made steady income for his employers, perhaps even better than steady. Every year, the revenues he generated almost doubled as compared to the previous year. During his last year, his income experienced a quantum leap as he saw the capital allocated to his trades swell beyond his wildest expectations. His bonus check was for $10 million, pre-tax, which would generate close to a $5 million total tax bill. John's personal net worth reached $1 million at the age of 32. By the age of 35, it had exceeded $16 million. Most of it came from the accumulation of bonuses, but a sizable share came from profits on his personal portfolio. Of the $16 million, about $14 million he insisted in keeping invested in his business. They allowed him, thanks to the leverage, i.e. use of borrowed money, to keep a portfolio of $50 million involved in his trades, with $36 million borrowed from the bank. The effect of the leverage is that a small loss would be compounded and would wipe him out. It took only a few days for the $14 million to turn into thin air and for John to lose his job at the same time. As with Carlos, it all happened during the summer of 1998, with the meltdown of high-yield bond values. Markets went into a volatile phase during which nearly everything he had invested in went against him at the same time. His hedges no longer worked out. He was mad at Henry for not having figured out that these events could happen. Perhaps there was a bug in the program. His reaction to the first losses was, characteristically, to ignore the market. "One would go crazy if one were to listen to the mood swings of the market," he said. What he meant by that statement was that the noise was mean reverting and would likely be offset by noise in the opposite direction. That was the translation in plain English of what Henry explained to him, but the noise kept adding up in the same direction. As in a biblical cycle, it took 7 years to make John a hero and just 7 days to make him a failure. John is now a pariah. He is out of a job, and his telephone calls are not returned. Many of his friends were in the same situation. How? With all that information available to him, his perfect track record, and therefore, in his eyes, an above-average intelligence and skill set, and the benefit of sophisticated mathematics, how could he have failed? Is it perhaps possible that he forgot about the shadowy figure of randomness? It took a long time for John to figure out what happened, owing to the rapidity with which the events unfolded, and his state of shell shock. The dip in the market was not very large. It was just that his leverage was enormous. What was more shocking for him was that all their calculations gave the event a probability of 1 in 10 to the 18th power years. Henry called that a 10 sigma event. The fact that Henry doubled the odds did not seem to matter. It made the probability 2 in 10 to the 18th power years. When will John recover from his ordeal? Probably never. The reason is not because John lost money. Losing money is something good traders are accustomed to. It is because he blew up. He lost more than he planned to lose. His personal confidence was wiped out. But there is another reason why John may never recover. The reason is that John was never skilled in the first place. He is one of those people who happened to be there when it all happened. He may have looked the part, but there are plenty of people who look the part. Following the incident, John regarded himself ruined. Yet his net worth is still close to $1 million, which could be the envy of more than 99.9% of the inhabitants of our planet. Yet there is a difference between a wealth level reached from above and a wealth reached from below. The road from $16 million to $1 million is not as pleasant as the one from zero to $1 million. In addition, John is full of shame. He still worries about running into old friends on the street. His employer should perhaps be most unhappy with the overall outcome. John pulled some money out of the episode, the $1 million he had saved. He should be thankful that the episode did not cost him anything, except the emotional drain. His net worth did not become negative. That was not the case for his last employer. John had earned for the employers, New York investment banks, around $250 million in the course of the 7 years. He lost more than $600 million for his last employer in barely a few days. The traits they shared. The reader needs to be warned that not all of the emerging market and high-yield traders talk and behave like Carlos and John. Only the most successful ones, alas, or perhaps those who were the most successful during the 1992 to 1998 bull cycle. At their age, both John and Carlos still had the chance to make a career. it would be wise for them to look outside of their current profession. The odds are that they will not survive the incident. Why? Because by discussing the situation with each of them,